So we were starting a new year. It's kind of hard to believe it's already a new year after spending a whole 12 months exploring the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And so this year, Chöri and I decided to focus on these qualities of mind, of the hindrances and the awakening factors. Right? So those of you who are tracking this, this shows up in the Fourth Noble Truth, or starting at the fourth foundation of mindfulness. The hindrances and the seven factors of awakening. Now it's interesting that some of the early Buddhist research shows that those may have been the original parts of that fourth foundation, and these other elements were added on. And you can ask, why is that? Because the hindrances are these expressions of our greed or hatred or delusion, you know, these unwholesome qualities of mind that cause so much suffering. And then you balance that with awakening factors to bring these qualities of investigation and mindfulness and joy and rapture, tranquility, equanimity. And these two help to balance each other. So we learn not only to be mindful of our mind when it's contracted, when it's acting from a place of lack, of separation, but also the quality of mind that leads toward liberation, the awakening factors. So we're beginning with the hindrances for this first 5 months, taking one at a time. And these hindrances, if you're not familiar, include desire, aversion, restlessness and worry, sloth and torpor, and doubt. Right? So these five qualities, if you've meditated for any length of time, you have experiences of these. Maybe you don't have the label for them, but there's something that very much happens as we start to practice. We bring, apply our energy to practicing, and we start to have these hindrances arise. They don't actually just arise in our meditative practices. They also arise in our daily lives, in our interactions with others. We just see them as highlighted in our meditative practices. So we try to meditate and we find ourselves being lost in thought, in fantasy, maybe planning that next vacation, maybe yearning for the bell. This is the quality of craving or desire arising. It's a sense of a movement toward. When I say movement, there's a mental component, there's a physical component, there's a almost physiological sense of needing to obtain this object of desire, you know, for that fantasy, that thought. Or perhaps we're noticing an unpleasant experience and we're really finding ourselves averse to that, moving away from that experience. This is the quality of aversion. Sometimes we find ourselves unable to sit still, or our mind is full of agitation and restlessness, of worry, of anxiety. This is the hindrance of restlessness and worry. Other times we find ourselves falling asleep, unable to have a crispness of attention, a dullness, a kind of a fog that settles over our minds. This is the hindrance of sloth and torpor. And other times we're just not sure where we're going. What are we doing in our practice? We're not sure if this is the right practice for us, if this is the right teacher, the right tradition. This is the hindrance of doubt. So these next 5 months we'll be exploring each of these one at a time, and then going into the awakening factors for the rest of the year. Now these hindrances, sometimes we think of them as a beginner topic, you know, something that we give beginners to kind of help them be able to stay on the cushion. Sometimes when I've taught in teaching teams and I'm the more junior teacher, I sometimes get assigned the hindrances because it will give them the basic teaching to give. But the hindrances themselves are much more than this kind of beginner thing that we all struggle with. It's something that the Buddha struggled with on the night of his awakening. You know, as he was striving to awaken, the armies of Mara were personified in these hindrances. They were coming at him with desire, with fear, with doubt. And his willingness to touch the earth and claim his place, this willingness to not flinch with those the armies of fear, not to go into the armies of desire, the alluring thoughts and images, those helped him to have to persevere, to awaken his heart and mind. So these hindrances are actually expressions of these much deeper roots of greed, of hatred, and delusion. Now, in our culture, there's a kind of heavy-hitting words to say someone is greedy or someone is full of hatred or delusion. But really, this is this much deeper, almost primal way that we tend to face the world. This kind of basic confusion about how things actually are, the actual nature of things. Some traditions, they call them the defilements, even poisons, unwholesome roots. And so again, those sometimes have a little bit of a charge to them. But really the point of practice is to learn to recognize when these are arising and to understand them to the point that they fall away. To understand them to the point that they fall away. Now, these deep roots, these kleshas, are often a little harder to see directly, to see the force of greed, the force of hatred, and the force of delusion. But the hindrances are much more accessible. We can actually see them operating. If you can learn to recognize when those are operating, when those are present, there's actually a pathway to understand the deeper root that's present. It's like a symptom of an underlying disease. You might have a fever, and you might try to cool the skin, but until you figure out what is actually causing that fever, where's the infection in the body, you know, the treatment is ineffective. So learning to investigate our practice, to investigate when these hindrances arise and seeing the much deeper root that's underlying them is so essential. So that's kind of the overview of these hindrances and the connection to these deeper roots. And so tonight, I wanted to focus in on the first hindrance, and that is of desire, or craving, or of wanting. Now, this one's a tricky one. Desire is tricky. They all are tricky because they have this, again, this expression of delusion, you know, certainly of greed and hatred. But this quality of delusion means that we get a little confused about what that hindrance is really asking us to do. And we get caught in a sense of desire, of wanting something. Really, the problem in that moment is the absence of the object of our desire. Right? If I had what I want, I would be happy, right? If I had that, you know, candy bar, if I had that relationship, if I had that car, that role, that retirement, that health, that mind state that I had last week, that retreat I had the last week, if I can just get back there, then I'll be happy. Right? So it's that leaning into the future, maybe from a memory of the past, saying, if I just had that again, I would finally be happy. There'd be some sense of completion. So it could be a physical object, it could be a relationship, experience, a role, a sense of identity. If I was successful, if I was, you know, seen in a certain way, that leaning into the moment. And so it's often, again, focused into the future, into this sense of becoming. If you reflect on times when you've been really caught in this sense of desire, it's like the whole world, when it's intense, the whole world kind of focuses in on that one thing. I remember in the past, focusing on just, in retrospect, silly things that I felt like I really needed in the moment, and almost this obsessive searching from one store to another to try to find this object. Right? And then once I had the object, it wasn't like suddenly angels started to blow trumpets and everything was at peace. It's just like, okay, that was kind of anticlimactic. But in the midst of the craving, it really has this sense of, I really need this. It's vital that I have this experience, this object, this thing. And if you look at physiology, you know, our physiology is kind of affirming that. Our heart rate is increased. Our breathing is increased. The hormones are going through our body. It's saying, yes, you really need to get this. Probably from our evolutionary base, you know, looking at searching for food, and that sense of desire was part of survival. So our physiology is kind of geared to do that. And then we start to feel this in our bodies. We actually feel these physiological changes, and it convinces us, oh yes, this is important. I really need to get this. It reaffirms their initial desire. This is why often we set a sense of, okay, I'm watching my intuition or listening to my gut. It can be misleading because it can be co-opted by these powers of desire. You know, how often is our sense of desire, a sense of craving, really what's in control, really what's driving this ship? And I can say next month we can look at aversion in the same way. It has that same kind of draw, that same kind of pull. So it's interesting to reflect on what this object of desire really is, what it really is. Because, you know, we may have this very concrete thing. If I just have that one object, that book or that car or that house or that relationship or that role or that food, something like that, it can seem very concrete, but really it's our mind's projection into what it means for us. It's our mind's assumption of what that represents, what that can mean. You know, it may be based in a total idea, in a fantasy, a projection. Maybe it's based on a past experience. And how many people have ever longed for that sense of peace in meditation that you've experienced? Or perhaps a deep insight that felt so changing, life-changing. It's like, oh, if I can just get back to that, then I'll be happy. And certainly this object of craving exists in our mind. It exists in the world of thought. And then it gets maintained by our further engagement into thinking. We have a thought and we say, oh, this thought is valid. This thought is true. I should follow that. I should add more to that. That's how the whole mechanism works. That's why the practice starts to really transform us when we start to see thought just as a mechanism of the mind, very similar to the sensation of the breath, the sensation of the body. Instead of having thought be such a statement of reality, we just see it as this play of the mind. The heart beats, the lungs breathe, and the mind thinks. And we start to become a little disenchanted with the thinking mind. Start to become disenchanted with the truth of those thoughts. You realize it's so arbitrary. We reflect back to this last meditative period. How many thoughts did you have which were really profound? And it's like, okay, that's life, a life-changing thought. It's like you think about dinner, or you think about tomorrow, or you think about this or that. And it's so random, it's so variable. But sometimes a thought arises that we really believe in, and then we invest all our energy into it. Now, it's also interesting to reflect. This is the interesting thing about desires, that we want something. Once we obtain it, what happens when we actually have that in our hands? You know, what's the result of that seeking, of that getting? Does it really live up to kind of the the marketing hype of our mind? Excuse me. Sometimes the dry air really gets at my throat. Okay. So when we achieve that goal, you know, does it really live up to what we hoped it would give us? Does it really live up to that promise of fulfillment, of peace? Well, how long does it last if it does? How long till the next movement toward craving arises? Often that movement of craving, that seeking it, it's not so much to obtain what we want, it's much more to alleviate the pain of the craving itself. Remember the story of the prince and the pauper. You know, each of those wanted each other's life. When the prince wanted to escape all the responsibility, thank you, Peter. And the pauper wanted the prestige and the richness of the prince, so they switched roles. But the reality of that switch didn't live up to their expectations. You know, so the funny thing about desire is that we forget all of this when the next desire arises. That's the delusional part that we forget. We keep trying the same strategy, hoping for a different outcome. Okay, those 100 things I wanted before, those were not quite off. But this one thing, this will actually do it for me. Right? This will actually do it. You see, if you start to see the power of mindfulness is instead of being lost in our patterns, lost in what we're engaged with, we're able to step back a little bit and actually see what's happening. We see the train that we've jumped on, the direction we're driving this car. You realize, oh, I'm caught in this pattern of craving, and it's gone down the same pathway again and again to the same outcome. And we look around, and we were surrounded by people who were also doing the same thing. You know, our whole society, our economy is based on you feeling inadequate. It's based on, if you desire this, you'll be happy. You know, don't look at my competitors. Look at this product, this soap, or this car, or whatever it might be. This will finally make you happy. Because everybody seems very happy in the ads, right? They seem so fulfilled. So this is kind of what we're up against, this power of delusion, of craving, of how we seek fulfillment. So how do we start to see through this delusion? How do we actually start to open through it in a dharmic way, you know, using the techniques in the art of meditation? How we start to see these deeper roots of greed and delusion, of aversion that you're operating. Now, how do we do that? So we often, in Buddhist cosmology, there's these different realms. You know, we don't often talk about that here at Sims. But the idea is that there's the human realm that we live on, but there's also these different unpleasant realms, like the realm of the hungry ghosts, where there's beings have enormous stomachs, but very small mouths. So they have to work so hard to get a little bit of nourishment and never can fulfill that deep hunger. And there's also the beastly realm and the hell realms. There's also the divine realms, you know, heavenly realms. And all of these realms are subject to impermanence and to dukkha. Right? So depending on how we live our lives, the cosmology tells us that we get reborn in these different realms. I tend to like to look at it more, this one lifetime has these different periods. There's maybe times when life is going really smoothly and everything is so easy. There's other times when it's very difficult. Maybe I'm racked with pain, physical illness. Other times I'm lost in desire, wanting into this hungry ghost realm. So one of the techniques or approaches to start to open into this quality of desire is that of investigation. Now, investigation is also one of the 7 factors of awakening. So you see there's the hindrances and then the counterbalancing of the 7 factors. Now, this investigative process allows us to start to focus our mindfulness, our attention, in a very clear, honest, specific way, to start to see through the fog or delusion, to see the much deeper message underneath. And in that process of seeing, we start to unhook the power of that. This is so simple about this practice. We don't have to change anything. We don't have to do anything other than simply see clearly. And we see clearly things let go of us. Things fall away of their own accord. So if investigation, we start to bring that sense of desire, we look at what's the underlying lack that's driving this. What's the underlying lack that the desire is trying to fulfill? Okay, so the first thing to do, and try to understand that and see that as deeply as we can. And not, this is not a superficial practice. This is one of the fundamental roots that if you see really through the deepest element of delusion, awakening happens. So it's not a small kind of, okay, just a little bit. It's like it's deeper practice. It takes tremendous sincerity and intentionality to see. And this willingness to meet ourselves, to drop away our assumptions of how we think we should be, how the world should be, to actually see the reality of how it is. But part of the knack of it is to start with right where you are. Let's say I'm really wanting, I'm craving something after sins, I'm going to go have that little treat. So it's that focus on that object, that desire. So the first thing is to notice that desire is present. It seems obvious, right? But how often do we actually know that we're desiring, that we're wanting? And instead we're focusing on what we want. You kind of see the sleight of hand? It's like, this is what I want. I don't actually notice the process of wanting. So when I start to notice that desire is present, I'm starting to let go of the object, suspending the belief that object will fulfill me, into the actual process of desire itself. And this means shifting into the felt sense of desire in the body. Feeling, how does this show up in my cells and my patterns of contraction, patterns of the heart contraction, emotionality. Starting to come into the present moment expression of that desire, not the future idea what that desire will fulfill. Do you kind of get a sense of that? It's like that shift from the future into this present moment. Now be warned though, doing this isn't pleasant. Okay, when you start to actually let go of the object of desire, I feel that as a process, there's an intensity to it. There's a sense of, I really need this. It's like it's almost like I'm an addict and I really need this hit. There's a sense of an urgency. The whole body is mobilized. And this is where the power of mindfulness comes in, the ability to meet this experience without flinching, without trying to change it, but simply to know it, one of the other factors of awakening. So once we start to get a sense of desire as an actual state, as a process that's separate from the object of our desire, separate from what we're seeking, then we can start to have a deeper investigation. And often asking simple questions like, what lack am I trying to fill? What lack am I trying to fulfill from this object, this person, this relationship, this thing? This role. And you just float the question. You float the question and just see what may emerge. Something may emerge immediately, it may take a while. When we do those dyads, when we pair up and someone asks a repeating question, and the person has a chance to answer it, and the question's asked again, and they find see what else arises. This is training you in the art of investigation. You know, to hold your attention on one topic, one point of inquiry, to the point that you see it in a different way, a different element than you had seen before. So you may say, okay, that sense of wanting, that object, I release the object, come into the experience of wanting, of desire. And maybe underneath there's a sense of, okay, that lack is maybe I want acceptance, I want love, I want fulfillment, I want some sense of comfort. And then you start to feel that sense more fully. Because often you have a clearer sense of that lack, there's a deeper hunger that you can actually access, that felt sense. And here's a nice loop to bring back in. Ask, that object that was so vital for me, that I was so desiring, can that fulfill that deeper lack? And sometimes by doing that, it's really sobering. You realize, I can chase after those categories of people, categories of objects, experiences forever, and will never touch this deeper lack. This deeper lack is untouched by whatever I might throw at it. And the hungry ghost is never satisfied. And then you ask, then you repeat the process, ask, what is underneath this? What lack is underneath this lack? And that deeper sense of approval, what's underneath that? And you continue until the original thing, you can just see that object has no connection to that deeper need. And this starts to sober us up a little bit. We start to realize, you know, seeking this again and again will not lead to any lasting happiness. It actually leads to opposite, leads to suffering in the short term and the long term. It reinforces the pattern of wanting again and again. And that sobering, the energy, the drive of that desire starts to fall away, starts to soften, and start to find the qualities of tranquility, of calm starting to rise, and other factors of awakening. So hopefully you can start to see how the awakening factors come right alongside the hindrances as a way to work with them, to understand them. And yet we don't stop here. When we finally see that this object won't satisfy this deeper lack, even deeper investigation starts to see the existential lack, the existential hunger that's inherent in this assumption of separation. It's really inherent in this sense of an independent, separate sense of self. When that sense of self is believed in, and that's an operating parameter, an operating assumption, there will always be lack. There will always be insufficiency, right? So then you try to fulfill that. You try to always find some way to bring that together. But the irony is that you can't do it that direction. You can't do it that way. This is why it's really fascinating to reflect on this, that there's a seed of wisdom in our very desire, that we're trying to come back to that sense of completion. This kind of core delusion of separation, of isolation, that I look out and there's other, and I look in and there's self. There's a reality too. There's a reality that we have different lives and different ideas, different histories. But there's a deeper reality that we're much more connected than different. It's only when we invest in thought, in belief, in identity, that the separation arises. When that starts to fall away, that sense of delusion of self falls away. And the non-separation, then there's no lack, there's no sense of inadequacy, no delusion. So this is the impulse that's underneath desire, is to try to come back to that sense of lack of lack, the release of lack. The delusion part of it is that we think we can solve that through objects, through experiences, through relationships. They can somehow find that place of deep connection, deep fulfillment by filling my life with things, with objects, relationships. And the irony is that once we see through that, then suddenly wherever we are, there's a deep connection. There's a deep relationship that's available without having to move one moment, one inch. So desire, you might have a question, like, is there a thing such as good desire? You know, because I kind of like to desire things. Do I have to give up all that to be a Buddhist and to practice? And I would say absolutely, there is absolutely good desire. Right, so before we explore what those are, let's explore when desire is a problem. Other than, you know, the root of our suffering. Often when there's kind of three areas we're just touch on here. We can recognize when desire is a problem when it's obsessive. When it's obsessive, when we start to really contract around it, when our whole focus, our mind, our energy is focused on this one thing in a contracted way, not in a wholehearted way, in a way that's healthy, but more in this contracted way, a driven way, that I have to have this. I need to have this. You know, my survival, my happiness, my well-being depends upon this, especially when we have a flavor of the month, and the next month it's another thing that we really need, right? And we just keep doing this over and over again. And those of us in the room who have a tendency toward desire, you know, we reflect, we kind of maybe get a little red-faced in how often we convince ourselves that we really need these things, right? I must have this. Now, also, desire is a problem when we're using it to avoid pain. We're using it to avoid unpleasantness or boredom, this sense of escape or avoidance. And how often do I sit down to work on some project, and before I know it, I'm checking my email, or I'm going to that website. You know, that's that sense of desires, like something's a little unpleasant. I don't really want to buckle down and work. So that unpleasantness, I try to alleviate that through going towards something pleasant. Right? So that little mechanism is so ingrained in us. You know, we're naturally, we want to have more comfort. We want to have more ease. We want to avoid pain. And yet, by doing that, by training ourselves to always go toward the pleasant, we... really what happens, there's some things we can't avoid, is there? There's some things we can't escape from. You know, many of us in the room have experienced that. When we have that diagnosis, and when we have that loss of relationship, loss of health, loss of job, of criticism, the pain is so much we can't escape from it. And as meditators, we develop this kind of... interesting taste for opening toward the difficult, opening to what is not usually what we want to open to. Because we realize by doing that, there's actually a freedom that comes from that, that we're not driven by that. That opening to it in the short term leads to a much longer term freedom, much longer term ease. And then in meditation, you know, when you start to find, okay, this is going on too long, my body's starting to hurt. How many of you start to plan that next vacation, or reminisce, or maybe write a new book on your retreat? It's like, okay, I've really got this great idea, and we've really gone into this quality of craving, of wanting. So when we use craving to and desire to avoid, to distract, you know, that becomes a problem. Now, certainly there's times to wisely distract ourselves. And we have, you know, deep grief, deep loss, deep stress. It's often very helpful to disconnect from that, to let ourselves kind of replenish, to come back into a sense of sufficiency. And the final way that we desire is a problem is that when it gets tied to the sense of me, the sense of self. Once I get that, I will be fill in the blank. Okay, when you hear yourself thinking that, it's a really good time to pause and just to reflect on that. That image of becoming a certain way, a certain person, a certain role, that in itself is really the fundamental seed of our suffering. It's not so much of becoming a better person. It's not so much of accomplishing things. That's not the issue. It's a sense of identity that we take with that. So it's this koan that we learn to work with, is how do we have a fulfilling life, a life that's successful, that's engaged, yet not based on this sense of me. That's a koan that we practice with in this tradition, in this life. Because once we come into that sense of me becoming something, for those of you familiar with the cycle of dependent origination, that cycle of tanha, of hunger, of desire, goes into that quality of becoming. I become this certain person who is wanting, that person who is successful, or the person who is not successful. That person, eventually that sense of self will fade. You know, is there a single role, sense of identity that you have that is everlasting? You know, I'm a father. You know, my sense of fatherness is transformed from a newborn to a 15-year-old. You know, I have to change that. For those of you who are retired, you reflect on when you're in the midst of your career, when that career, when you let go of that, how that's a change of identity. For those of you who have lost a dear one, either through death or through ending of a relationship, how there's a change of that sense of you. That change of self is where the suffering arises. The more we invest in that sense of self, the more suffering will happen. It's not to say we don't engage with life fully, we don't engage in relationships, but we also just hold that sense of me lighter and lighter, seeing through it more and more to see the illusion it is. So then, good desire, spiritual desire. So certainly there's a desire that when we want to just truly nurture ourselves, take care of ourselves, so self-care. I was on a retreat, you know, non-residential here, and it was really, I was walking meditation, I was really cold. I was like, okay, a cup of hot tea would really be good. I desired that. And it was that clear nourishment. That sense of attending to ourselves. So we have to be careful with our deep cultural religious training and background of the hair shirt, you know, the self-flagellation. That sometimes we like, okay, I'm just going to punish myself till I become spiritual enough, right? So we have to watch that tendency. You know, in Buddhist time, that was a big, and still probably times in India, there's these times that there's traditions that really punish the body, self-mortification, right? So that's off there. So don't misuse this teaching on working with desire to fuel self-punishment, self-neglect. There can be a desire to lessen or end suffering. You know, I want to end suffering in myself. I want to end suffering in you, in your life, in all beings. That desire is wholesome. And then aspiration, the desire. The aspiration is kind of the spiritual quality of the heart is leading toward something bigger than you are, beyond what is known, beyond this prison of our minds, the prison of greed and hatred and delusion. And this is a spiritual desire. And as we open to that and reflect on that, only good comes of that. There's nothing to hold on to. There's nothing to cling in these much deeper qualities of desire. All right, so let's just sit quietly for a few moments and let those words settle. Thank you for your kind attention. And so before we go into questions or answers or comments, I'd like to just talk about the practice and reflection sheet. You know, these are the called homework sheets in the past. And so the idea with these sheets, it's a way to start to take the topic of the talk and bring it into your life, bring it into your daily practice. And that's where it becomes alive. You know, if we just listen to it, it has a limited value. We start to actually apply it to see how does this really show up. You know, take it as a laboratory, your life as a laboratory. You know, just maybe assume that everything I said was wrong and test it. You know, see how can I tell if that's true or not? That is there any limitations to desire, to wanting? And this reflection also is an important shift for us to make if you haven't made this yet, that this meditative practice isn't just a breath meditation. It's not a body meditation. It's a meditation of the expression of life. So we take the first training of the breath and the body, so important to ground us, to center us. But we take that same quality and now turn it toward the shape of our mind, to be mindful of mind. the mindfulness case of desire. You know, how is desire operating? And the body is a very helpful ally in this, because we can see how desire shows up as a body experience. How is the felt sense of desire, the tightness, that hunger in the body? So this week, become aware, become more attuned to desire as it arises. Be like a bloodhound, sensitive to that subtle scent of desire. Okay, there's desire happening. Meet this with curiosity, not with your usual judgment and have to get rid of desire. But actually, let me understand it. Let me actually see what this is like. What does it feel like? What's the message of that? Notice how often your impulses to act, to think, to do, to think, to feel, are really driven by desire. Just start to notice that connection. Notice it as a felt sense of in the body, of the energy in the body. And also, as you do this, notice what happens to the object of desire as you practice in this way, as you shift into the body sense. What happens to the object? All right, so next week we'll have a discussion. I'll do a recap, maybe some elaboration of this talk, and then we'll have a chance to see what you explored around desire. So now we have a chance for some, you know, comments or questions about this or anything else that's on your mind. Yes, Jerry.
I was just talking about what you said. For me, I think there's so the word desire sort of started to have a negative connotation of the whole thing.
Right.
So, anyway.
Sure. Yes. Yes. Yes, so the reflection was that the word desire itself, sometimes it can get a negative connotation through, especially when we talk about it in this way. But there's a difference between desire that takes us out of the present moment versus actually really meeting what our needs are in the moment. That's more of quality of wisdom. And you can often notice with desire, you know, what happens when that is over. You know, when you've received that cup of tea, for example, there's a sense of fulfillment, of satisfaction. When it's a desire that's perhaps, you know, more of those you say dysfunctional ways or driven by greed and hatred, delusion, there's like the next desire that comes up. You know, there's a quality of being more agitated or more busy in the mind. The heart is more unsettled. Well, when there's that more of that wise desire, then there's a sense of, okay, stillness that comes, a sense of calmness. Yes, thank you. Yes, Valerie.
Sometimes I'm not sure if we're just a desire to play versus just good or bad desire.
Yes.
Especially if, for example, if we're in the colleague, but I'm only as part of the relationship, but at the same time, I feel the desire to have that positive relationship. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard to distinguish the line between how much you should put effort into it or how much you should let be.
Yeah. All right, so just to repeat the question if you had trouble hearing. So distinguishing between desire, you know, when is it a wholesome desire versus, you know, unwholesome, particularly like around like a work situation when you want the relationship to be harmonious, you want to have a sense of balance. But there's also maybe a questioning, is that, am I getting too caught in being a certain way or that sense of identity getting caught in that? And, you know, where's that gray line between wholesome desire and unwholesome desire, and, you know, and is it how do you navigate that? Is that basically it? Yeah, this is, you know, a lot of these questions are really kind of life koans. You know, it's our life presents us with that. Okay, so there's that sense of wanting to have this harmonious relationship with this other person. Okay, so that's wonderful. And then you just, okay, you sit with that a little bit and notice, is there any kind of conditions to that? I want it harmonious as long as they always agree with me, or I'm always right, or, you know, harmonious means that we're quiet and not chatty, or, you know, those kind of conditions that can kind of come up, that way that we, well, that more powerful way is more like, okay, let me connect with this other person and see what really what their needs are, what their human needs are. You know, and express that sense of interconnection. And so a lot of it for me comes with how fluid I'm able to be versus how rigid I am. So the more rigid I am means I want it to look a certain way. And I've kind of shifted into that you know, the desire that's more of a hindrance. But if there's a desire, but I'm really willing to work however I need to be, that sense of fluidity with it, you know, of course, keeping ethics, keeping all these, my own boundaries intact. But there's a sense of fluidity, a sense of being compromised and dance with the other person, then it's much more of a wholesome desire. And so that's often kind of the guide that I use. And when so the trick is to notice both qualities. When I find myself kind of, okay, I really want this to be a certain way, okay, sit back and really investigate that. You know, is that because I need to feel safe? I need to feel respected? I need to feel secure? You know, and also notice when I'm able to be more fluid, you know, am I abandoning myself? Am I just being a, you know, what do you call it, a Gumby person without any bones in my body? You know, I'm not having that backbone. Yeah, so there's not a, you know, one right answer. It's much more of like walking a tightrope. You know, you have to constantly be balancing, constantly asking that same question. And probably the simplest instruction is just to really literally touch into this quality of the heart area and see, can I be acting from there? You know, because the mind, we can kind of rationalize, we can explain and justify, we can get caught in, you know, an object of craving, of aversion. But coming to the quality of heart, the heart has these other qualities of patience, of love, of acceptance, of equanimity, strength, power, you know that fierceness. All those qualities are much more, it's like you learn to attune your ear to when is the heart speaking, when is my mind speaking. And that becomes more and more clear. And a lot of it is through trial and error. You know, when we're working well, the other person responds well. If we're not working well, they let us know. And there's like, okay, something needs to be adjusted here. Yeah. You're welcome. But there's working with that, it's a really good testing ground of your practice. You're welcome. Good learning ground. What else? Anyone else? Yes, Lauren.
It sounded like you were suggesting that we might do a self dialogue where we would ask the same question like we do when we have the duos.
Dyads.
Dyads, right.
Yeah.
So we say the same question over and over again. And then we just keep going deeper with that question. So, for example, if I said, you know, what am I desiring? And I would probably start with the object and say that I desire.
Right.
Say it's a relationship or it's an experience.
Sure.
Or whatever. So
right.
I would start with that. And then I would just keep repeating it. What am I desiring? What am I desiring? And just keep asking that question. Until I go deeper and deeper, and you're talking about this elemental, you just keep finding that it's really something deeper and deeper and deeper. And then you suggested that at some point you see that it's not possible to get that. Except that you said that the factors of awakening come in, or something happens at that point. Say that
again. It kind of reminds me of the Far Side cartoon where the guys will have this big, long, you know, elaborate formula, and they say, then a miracle happens, and then...
Well, I just wanted to hear that one more time.
Sure.
That
makes sense to me. Yeah, so to kind of paraphrase that again for the recording and also for my clarity of mind. So when we're having a sense of desire arising, I suggested using investigation as a tool to see the deeper roots of that, to not get so caught in the identity of what that object means. I mean, that's how if we keep doing the same thing, we're going to have the same results, right? So it's part of it. We just have to eventually see the limitation of that strategy. Okay, so the limitation of that strategy, when we really get like that sense of hitting bottom, okay, I'm not going to do this another time. Then we're starting to sober up and not be so caught in the object of desire. Now, instead of focusing on the object of, you know, what is it I'm desiring? I mean, that's part of it. What is it I'm desiring? But more, what is the lack? What is the lack this is trying to fulfill? Right? Because the object, we already know, you know, the object we're pretty fixated on. But it's more what is the lack this is supposed to fulfill that lack? That's the part we don't often see. And because we don't see it, that lack's kind of driving us underneath the surface. We keep going from, you know, this is going to fit the lack? No, not quite. How about this one? No, no, no. And we, you know, we try thousands in a day. Depending, you know, anyway. So when you start to realize that, okay, then where's this lack? The dyad model is so powerful because, you know, usually we have trouble keeping our attention on something, especially something that's painful or sensitive or just has a whole lot of delusion around it. It's like we're kind of going through the fog and it's thick and viscous and, you know, it's unpleasant and we just, you know, we want to stop going that direction. We want to go back to where we know where things are. You know, if I get that candy bar, I'll be happy. Yeah, that's the sunlight. So you have to be willing to go into the deep forest, basically. So having someone keep asking you, so where's the lack? Okay, you have to keep coming back. So that's the hard part of investigation by yourself is you have to keep summoning that energy, even though, you know, it's very difficult. You know, I'll think of all the fairy tales when the hero is having to chop through the brambles and go against all these odds. You know, so that repeating question, and the question does matter. So some questions, you get a knack of what leads you in the right way versus which ones are more superficial. So like the desire, you know, okay, what am I desiring? Okay, it's X. Okay, well, now what? What's the lack? You start to feel, oh, I get a little bit more settled, or I start to get more confused. Right, okay, I have that perseverance. Okay, where's that sense? What am I lacking that I hope this will fulfill? And you just be very patient with that. Feel it as a body experience, that sense of hunger, of desire, of lack. And I say, oh, you know, I want to be accepted. You know, I want to be safe. And then you kind of feel that as an experience, that hunger for that. I mean, that's, we all want to be that. And you start to see that candy bar doesn't help me feel safe, doesn't help me feel loved, or, you know, whatever that is. You have to find that for yourself. And if you keep going a little deeper, you can see that sense of safety. Okay, what's the lack underneath that, or what's the deeper drive? And I can always get this vision of these currents, you know, that are driving our lives. Maybe like the magma sheets underneath the earth that are moving these tectonic plates. You know, we look at the plates, and we start to see the current underneath that. And we keep going down until there's no more current. So there might be a current here, there might be a deeper current. You know, what are those currents? So the question may have to adjust. So once you kind of get a knack of it, it starts to become really almost interesting. Especially when you get in a deep way and you see, oh, this lifelong desire to be accepted, to be seen, you know, all these behaviors I do don't touch that deeper lack. And it's like, oh, then you just have to remind yourself when you start to engage in that, oh, that's this deeper pain. And then compassion comes in. It just that sense of pain. And then after a while, when that starts to soften, then there's this sense of, okay, what's underneath this? What would be if I wasn't even someone or something that needed to be loved? You know, and there's a deeper stillness that comes from that. Then we're really starting to unhook the deeper patterns of this sense of self. You know, and this is what this whole process is about. This is really the point of all this. So thank you for that question. What else? Yes, Susan.
I like that comment you said about we get to work with the difficult. And on my job, sometimes I feel like I have this, I don't have a map of what's going to happen. I kind of walk into a situation, don't really know what's going to happen.
Oh, sure.
I may not have, you know, things on the board might not even be correct. And I have seen a shift of, I see my body want to clench for control because there's that sense of, you know, I need to, you know, sail the ship, I'm the captain, and I've seen myself, you know, ask the question, or ask, you know, why am I taking this on? And I found that, you know, that subtle thing is about control, and I ask, you know, is that true? And I make myself wrong for it. Like, I'm doing something wrong. Mm. And like, well, no, wait a minute. Look at the situation I'm in. So I've been practicing, like, is it true? And, you know, why am I taking it on? Like, I need to somehow make it right. So I'm starting to see the positive desire of, you know, kind of giving myself permission to just, you know, hold this space. I'm practicing this right now, so I'm kind of self-talking to myself too. Hold a space, letting the situation be very imperfect, if it is, and that's my, you know, qualifying comment. And the more I let go, you know, the more peace I have and access to what really matters. So I'm that's up for me right now, and it's. I know I said it's related to faith, and I know that's not what we're talking about right now, but I'm kind of needing that. I'm looking at that as a counter.
Yes.
There's two people operating.
yeah, absolutely. So just to. Just paraphrase that if I can. There's, you know, basically, you know, life is chaotic. You know, there's all kinds of different relationships, there's different dynamics. And, you know, as like in your role as a teacher, you come in and there's this dynamic that's set up and they have their, it's like you don't, you know, there's a lot of chaos in the situation. And it's absolutely true that we have to, you know, there's a sense of responsibility that comes up, but how to find that gateway. You know, there is that sense of the choice of control, of contraction, and trying to, you know, make it happen the way it should. And there's a quality of relaxation, centering, and in that there's a lot of responsiveness, a sense of fluidity that happens. And making that leap is really one of faith, right? So it's like with kind of tie back into the desire time. Desire is kind of our normal strategy. A desire. Calm, centered kids who are paying attention. And then reality kind of confronts us with that, right? And so then we're kind of in that pattern of suffering. So we can keep plowing through that or we can have a different way. Faith is the willingness to say, okay, I don't know. I don't know what's to do here. I'm just gonna simply I know the best way to find that out is to make contact with my heart, with my center, and see what arises. All right, anyone else? Thank you. Yes.
So using the attain part, if I attain a one, then I'll be happy.
Right.
Or more realistically, why don't get a candy bar, I'll still do the same because I don't have a candy bar now. And the contract, like, what happens when it is swinging more negative, like, if the contract is worth, if my project succeeds, I may be rewarded, or at least keep my job. If my project fails, then I lose social currency.
Right. So the crux of that is the sense of failure versus succeeding, and then so let me see if I can paraphrase that. So, like in a work situation, when your performance means whether you succeed or if you don't perform well, you might lose that job. And so, where does desire come in a healthy way or in a dharmic way? Should you just release the outcome and just see what happens? Or, is there a way to kind of engage with that? Is that kind of... Yeah, these are all very pertinent, very real questions for us as we struggle or tackle this quality of desire and how it really works. So, of course, we have preferences, right? We have a preference for success, for accolades, for promotions. We have a strong preference for not being fired and being, without work. So there's preferences. And so then we just try to align ourselves as best we can with that. And so this is where you kind of get to a little bit of that gray area, like Valerie's question, is where do we really apply our best efforts in a very fruitful way, in an engaged way? And where does that start to shift into that quality of desire that's really driven by greed, hatred, and delusion? Is that, yeah. And so that question, I would reflect, okay, what would be, how would I be if I did fail terribly? What would happen? How would that reflect on kind of the essence of who I am? Not the preferences, not the chaos that would happen in my life, but just the essence of who I am. If you define yourself who you are in relationship to whether you succeed or not, it's a little bit fragile, right? Because that's going to always be changing. Praise and blame, gain and loss. So how can I have an essence of who I am? And this is much more the sense of this is kind of getting out there a little bit. Let me see if I can bring it back down. So basically, the more that your self-esteem, your sense of well-being is tied to the outcome, the more potential suffering there is. And is there a way to tie your actions so it's not so driven by that? And this is actually a big shift. And Eric had a question about this the other day. That's kind of what motivates us, right? Okay, if I work hard, then I'll be good. And so the Dharma kind of just brings a little bit of a questioning to that. So it's not a clear answer how to work with that. All right, so we're come to the end of the dialogue. You're always welcome to come up and ask more questions.